Coming up on Triangulation, I talked to Cory Doctorow from the EFF and Boing Boing and author of so many great books, including Little Brother and Walk Away and his newest book, Radicalized, Four Short Tales of Our Present Time.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 396, recorded on March 25th, 2019, for May 3rd, 2019. Cory Doctorow, Radicalized. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show that every week we talk to some of the most interesting people working in technology. And today I'm super excited because I have he wins the award of being on Triangulation the most times. He is an activist, a journalist, a writer, a consultant for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and author of many books, but his newest book is Radicalized. It's four novellas about our present moment. I'm, of course, talking about, and two, Cory Doctorow. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to be back. I had no idea I was your most frequent guest.
You were on episode 10.
Yeah.
That was back when it was Leo and Tom Merritt, and then you were on episode 92.
Uh-huh.
And episode 295.
Uh-huh.
And now this episode, which is 300 and something.
And this time I finally made it into your studio.
Yeah, you made it here. And I fought Leo to get to interview. I was like, you've done it three times. And we met in 2000. You used to be a guest on the Screensavers.
Screensavers, sure.
Yeah.
Back when I lived in the Mission and you guys had a studio in the Mission.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was telling Cory that I still have a very fond memory of him pulling me over to his computer and saying, look at this thing that I just discovered. And it was RSS. And it was magic.
My friend Carl Schrader, a science fiction writer, very good science fiction writer, he is the first person who ever said the word fractal, internet, and web to me.
Oh, and I still remember that.
I still remember that, yeah.
Yeah. It is kind of our, like, when JFK was shot. It's like,
yeah.
Do you remember when you first got an email?
Yeah.
It's a happier thing. So I just, Leo got to most of the good stuff, like your family and, your background. And so I'm excited just to talk about this book because it is, I mean, you are a sci-fi writer, but in a lot of ways I see you as sort of a futurist as well. Hmm. I look back to the episode that you recorded in 2013 with Leo, and you talk about Facebook. You just, Facebook has systematically violated our privacy. And I just think about that. Like, people weren't necessarily saying that as much in 2013. Do you ever get tired of, like, saying things that, like, a decade or 5 years later, people are like, did you know that Facebook violates our privacy?
So I don't like the idea of futurism because I think that if the future is predictable, then there's no reason to get out of bed, right? Mm-hmm. I think the future changes based on what we do, which is why I'm not tired of fighting fights, getting to the fight before everyone else gets there, because part of the way that we get everyone to the fight is by starting to talk about it. You have to open the conversation. And I have a theory that's that, I call it the peak indifference theory, where if you have a real problem and that real problem has causes and effects that are really widely separated, it can be sometimes really hard to convince people that the problem even exists. Mm-hmm. Think about climate change, say. If you're the air around your car got warmer every time, a little exhaust came out of your tailpipe, we wouldn't have any arguments about climate change. It's only these long gaps between cause and effect that make it possible. And of course, that's exacerbated if someone can make money off of doubt. Mm-hmm. And so, the link between smoking and cancer, the link between Facebook privacy invasions and a degradation of our quality of life, those links aren't just hard to spot because of the gap between cause and effect, but also because someone is sowing doubt, right? There comes a day, if we don't convince people fast enough that this is a problem, we need to do something about it. There comes a day when people start convincing themselves because the problem will get so bad that it will become undeniable. People just have their lives destroyed by it. Yeah. Whether that's getting cancer if you smoke long enough or the floods coming to your town if climate change goes on long enough, or Facebook or one of the other companies having a horrible rupture and blowing up your democracy and ruining your life and doing all kinds of other terrible things. So, I, at that point, you know, the job changes, right? The job starts convincing people that there is a problem. The job changes to convincing people that it's not too late, right? Because denialism can then just become nihilism in a second. And, you know, there's always this risk, right? If it takes me so long to convince you that we should care about rhino populations, that by the time you come around, there's only one rhino left, it's really powerfully tempting to figure out what it tastes like, you know? And so convincing people that there's time to act, that's the job I'm more interested in now, laying out what people can do next to try and to remediate these crises that we find ourselves in and avert the kind of ultimate crisis, the existential crisis.
Well, do you think that technology sometimes helps that doubt, like helps us not care about it? Like I'm thinking of in climate change, you hear people talking about like the singularity. Well, at least we have the singularity. We can do whatever we want to the environment because, you know, our brains will be uploaded into the great computer in the sky.
Yeah. You know, it's when I tell people that I don't think science fiction can predict the future, they ask me then what relationship it has with the future. And I think that it's the kind of oracle that science fiction is. It's an oracle that diagnoses the present moment. So whatever science fiction is popular in the present moment tells you a lot about our kind of underlying or subconscious yearnings and aspirations and fears about technology. So the singularity, it's a science fiction idea, right? It's a religious belief, right? A belief in transcendence. Mm-hmm. We don't know what intelligence is. So any theories that someday we'll simulate intelligence inside a machine involve this huge, you know, leap of faith, right? Magic underpants gnomes thinking where you have a step two, which is like figure out what human intelligence is, right? And until we have that, we are not going to simulate human intelligences in machines, let alone port our human intelligences into machines. And so the fact that that's very popular, I think, tells you that we are still in denial about climate change, or maybe we're in bargaining, right? If you think about the steps, denial and bargaining and so on, sleepy, dopey, making amends. I forget all the steps in that model, but you know, if we're like, well, okay, maybe climate change is coming, but we can just upload our brains into computers, then we're probably just bargaining
right.
at this point.
Yeah. So your story, all four of these stories are like in the near future.
Sure.
They could happen right now. They could happen tomorrow. The first one is very, very you, very Cory Doctorow. Of course, it involves sort of DRM, but DRM toast. Mm-hmm. The first story, Unauthorized Bread. I meant to ask you if you wanted to read the first few paragraphs.
I could read something from it. There's a bit that I like to read, if it's okay.
There's
a bit,
you can look
through
it.
I'll find you the passage.
Okay. Stuff.
I started off on this tour, because I'm in the middle of a book tour. I started off reading from a section in the story Radicalized about, you know, suicide bombers and dying kids. And it turned out not to be like a real, like, it was a riveter. But it didn't really set the tone for a fun evening, right? kicking off the event with like, let me just read you a bit about suicide and dead kids, and then we'll have an hour-long discussion.
Right, you can ask me anything.
Kind of brought the tone down.
Yeah.
So I found a nice fun bit to read. Let me see if I can find that section here.
I'm sorry to spring that on you.
No, I was going that's
to ask
okay. So this is the story. I'll set it up a bit. It's about people in refugee housing where everything is some horrible Internet of Things gadget designed to milk them of every penny they might have. The dishwasher only washes authorized dishes and the toaster only toasts authorized bread. And that's bad enough. But then, of course, the hedge fund that owns all of these terrible devices, being comprised of the kind of idiots who think this would be a good idea, financially engineer themselves into bankruptcy and all the appliances stop working. And Salima, who's a Libyan refugee who's raised in camps, her parents died in the crossing from Libya, she has to figure out how to jailbreak her devices just so she can make a piece of toast for breakfast. And let me see if I can find the bit here. The toaster didn't go easily. After downloading the new firmware from the darknet, she had to remove the case, slicing through three separate tamper evidence seals and a large warning sticker that threatened electrocution and prosecution, perhaps simultaneously, for anyone foolish enough to ignore it. and locate a specific component and then short out two of its pins with a pair of tweezers while booting it. This dropped the toaster into test mode that the developers had deactivated but not removed. The instant the test screen came up, she had to jam in her USB stick. Removing the toaster's hood had revealed a set of USB ports, a monitor port, and even a little Ethernet jack, all stock on the commodity single-board PC that controlled it. At exactly the right instant, and then used the on-screen keyboard to tap in the login and password, which were admin and admin, of course. It took her three tries to get the timing right, but on the third try, the spare login screen was replaced with a pirate firmware's cheesy text art animation of a 3D skull, which she smiled at, and then she burst into laughter as a piece of text art toast floated into the frame and was merrily chomped to crumbs by the text art skull, the crumbs cascading to the bottom of the screen and forming shifting little piles. Someone had put a lot of effort into the physics simulation for that ridiculous animation. It made Salima feel good, like she was entrusting her toaster to deep, serious craftspeople, and not just randos who like to pit their wits against faceless programmers from big, stupid companies. The crumbs piled up as the skull chomped and the progress bar indicator counted up from 12% to 26% and then to 34%, where it stuck for a full 10 minutes until she was ready to risk really bricking the damn thing by unplugging it, but then 58% and so on to an agonizing wait at 99%. And then all of the crumbs rushed up from the bottom of the screen and went back out through the skull's mouth, turning back into toast, each reassembled piece forming up in ranks that quickly blotted at the skull, and the words "all done" burned themselves into the toast surface, glistening with butter that ran down in rivulets. She was just grabbing for her phone to get a picture of this awesome pirate load screen when the toaster oven blinked and rebooted itself.
It's so funny. I mean, just it's dark, but also really funny.
Sure. I mean, and if anyone like remembers, you know, sort of Amiga pirate scene floppies that played the Pirates of the Caribbean song and gave you an 8-bit animation, you know, it's a bit of an homage to that. But also, you know, we live, if not the darkest timeline, in one of the kind of weirdest timelines in which, like, we have, like, legit folk art about progress bars. And I also wanted to kind of dig into that because I think that that's an experience that's become very universal.
Right. And we do have devices that only cook certain, you know, like, I guess you can buy any kind of Keurig pods, but there are...
Well, and remember, Keurig put DRM in their pods and nearly went into business.
Yeah.
But, you know, this all started, I wrote a... I used to get into these arguments with people about, like the iPhone DRM. And I said, look, if I'm a programmer and I write some software and I own the copyright to it, and you're an iPhone owner and you own the computer and you want to run my copyrighted software on your device, why is it that copyright law says that you can't do that unless Apple sells it to you and takes 30% out of my pocket? In what way does that serve copyright's ends, right? And people would say, oh, it makes you safer, it's more efficient, it's more elegant. It's, you know, they just had all these excuses, like you know, like a kidnap victim telling you why their hostage takers are really good guys or something. So I wrote this essay in The Guardian, a little kind of bit of design fiction called If Dishwashers Were iPhones. And it was a letter from the CEO of a Jobsian dishwasher startup who was explaining to people that foodborne illnesses had killed more people than any other cause in human history, that you couldn't expect to get your dishes really clean and sanitary if you could just load grandma's china in there. Plus, you know, if you wanted to make your own dishes, you could always buy a dishwasher developer license and throw your own pottery and put the RFID tags in it. And, you know, those dish manufacturers whose copyrighted dishes were available in the dishwasher store, they had put a lot of effort into it. And if you jailbroke your dishes, you could buy pirate dishes and so on and so on and so on. You know, ultimately, like, the thing is, if you own that dishwasher, you should have the right to put any dishes you want in it, even if the manufacturer doesn't agree, even if it gores the manufacturer's shareholders' ox. That's what it is to own property. Mm-hmm. If you ever do like a first-year law course, the first thing you learn is this quote from Blackstone, a 16th century quote that says, property is that which man enjoys sole and despotic dominion over to the exclusion of every other man in the universe, right? If like the owner of the device... If their hand sits on it for as long as you own the device, ready to kind of lift up and go upside your head if you have the temerity to arrange your affairs to benefit you instead of their shareholders, you don't own that device. That's just feudalism.
There's a moment in that story, too, where the main character meets somebody who works at that company.
Yeah.
And it's a great categorization of just sort of the haves and the have-nots, I guess. Like, the person who works there is a recent graduate or maybe even still in college and sort of an optimist. But then when they have this interaction and, you know, it's a Boulanger.
Boulangism.
Boulangism. That's the toaster.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, to, you know, recall the boulanger.
Yeah.
Boulangerie.
Boulangerie.
Yeah.
You're making me really dig into my Canadian French here.
And she says, well, do you own one? And the woman who works at the company says, of course I don't. Why do you?
Sure. And, you know, so the first day I worked for EFF, probably not long after we first met, we flew to LA for the first meeting of something called the Broadcast Protection Discussion Group that was cooking up this thing called the Broadcast Flag, which thankfully we sued the FCC over and knocked down after it was passed. And it was this proposal to put DRM in every device capable of tuning a digital television signal, which was all PCs in the world, right? And it had this exemption in it for professional equipment. And it occurred to me that every other person in the room thought that that was the exception that they would get to take advantage of, right? None of them planned on using a device that was bound by the broadcast flag. And then I went to Europe and I did this DRM for TV standard that I worked on called CPCM for DVB, which is European and Australian, Japanese and South American DRM or TV standards for digital TV. And it defined what a family was because it was going to let you share your programs with your family. Mm. So it had to decide what was and wasn't a valid family. And again, it occurred to me that, like, even though we were talking through these use cases, like, well, if you had joint custody of your kids and your 12-year-old went to your wife's house for a week and then your house for a week, and then the system, it tripped a thing that the system thought was content laundry, that kid could call an 800 number and explain the circumstances of your divorce to someone in a call center in Manila, that none of these people were imagining that their kid would ever have to do that.
Right.
Right? That's a really common refrain in technology. And, you know, these people assume that either they'll be able to jailbreak with impunity or that they just won't be within the scope of the rule. And, you know, I think that under normal market circumstances where you don't have things like the DMCA and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and trade secrecy, that somewhere out there is a nerd who has that impulse, who the way that they'll express that impulse is, oh, I'll just make a tool that lets everyone unlock it. Because, you know, if it's true that people don't mind their iPhones only running Apple-approved software, then no one will buy that tool and no one would have to worry. And I have a theory that people do want that tool, and so I'll make it and I'll sell it in the market and see if anyone buys it. And if Apple's really confident that everyone's happy with phones that only run software from the App Store, then let's call their bluff, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. So one of the things about Unauthorized Bread, too, is the main character is a refugee. Several of the main characters are.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me how they get subsidized housing. And it just showed me that something we don't really talk about, but a lot of these disadvantages or a lot of these invasive technologies are tried on people, poor people first.
Yeah.
And I was also thinking of, it made me think of the Amazon tablets, the Fire tablets that are so cheap. Mm-hmm. And this idea that, oh, I can entertain my child, but basically you're handing them a device that can only play Amazon stuff. And then you're basically saying, and for the rest of your life, maybe you'll be an Amazon consumer.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other examples of this kind of thing that goes on pretty regularly?
Well, you know, you can start with things like CCTV, right? Like, literally the only people who had cameras watching them all day long at the start was prisoners, right? And then it was mental patients, and then it was school kids, and then it was blue-collar workers, and now it's white-collar workers, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're all subject to that kind of scrutiny. Censoring firewalls, mm-hmm. you know, the we started off just throwing them at schools as a result of the Communications Decency Act, and then they spread to corporate America, and then, you know, also to offshore dictatorships, and often it's the same companies supplying all of them, you know, these companies like divisions of, even of Intel, that, you know, on the one hand service Bahrain and help censor material that insults the king, and then they take that same tool and they use it to censor your kid's school, and then they take that same tool and they vend it into an airport and then also into a workplace, and it follows this bad technology gradient from you know the meekest among us all the way up to those with the most agency, or even things like remote camera activation by third parties, by network administrators or authority figures. You know, that was originally a feature of things like prisons, right, where you'd have computer labs, but you could have spyware on the device that allowed the lab to be administered by someone who could check for compliance. And then it went into call centers. And then, you know, famously, the Lower Merion School District, the wealthiest school district in America, gave every one of its kids laptops with secret remote camera activation features that the principal of the school used to take 6,000 photos of a kid that he suspected of selling drugs and, you know, asleep and awake and around their parents and so on. And eventually, like, it got caught. He got caught because he called the kid in for a meeting and said, I have a photo of you taking drugs. And it was a photo of this kid in his bedroom the night before. And he was like, that's a Mike and Ike's candy. I eat them all the time. How did you get this picture of me? But, you know, now you have rent-to-own laptop companies that do this in the name of theft recovery. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of those settled with the FTC for secretly recording their customers having sex and for plundering their hard drives for fun music and for taking videos of them while they were walking around naked in their house or their kids while they were walking around naked in their house. And the FTC settlement had no penalties, just a covenant not to do it anymore. Or if they did, they would have to put it in their terms and conditions and prominently display it. And now, of course, you have a whole range of technologies that enact surveillance of you all the time. You know, whether that's the camera in your living room that is not end-to-end encrypted to the app that allows you to monitor it. So, like, Canary has these drop cams that send data encrypted to their data center, but then it's in the clear in their data center, so they can do machine learning to, like, filter out, you know, cats tripping the motion sensor. But it also means that anyone who betrays Canary or compromises Canary or an employee who turns out to be not entirely trustworthy has access to the video of all of their customers. You see this with Ring doorbells. Just recently, there was a bunch of security reports on the locks that you buy for your high-end car to make up for the fact that the lock that it comes with is a piece of garbage subject to radio replay attacks where I can capture the fob's interaction with the car and then unlock your car later. So now they have these other locks that you put on that cost thousands of dollars. And those locks do all their work in the clear. And like they have open APIs and you can get them to enumerate all the customers and you can immobilize cars and you can listen in on the microphones and so on. This started, you know, with prisoners. And now it's in the lives of people who own Maseratis. I think a Maserati is a high-end car. I'm not a car guy.
Well, I don't know. I think it still is.
A Ferrari.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Ferrari. And then just the fact that privacy is expensive. Mm-hmm. And it really is dividing. I mean, you know, there are certain, whenever anyone talks about, there was a Kashmir Hill, you know, did the whole, I don't know if you read the.
Yeah, the Life Without the Platforms.
And that one laptop, she bought a laptop that was like completely, you know, private. I can't remember the company, but I mean, it was
System 76 or Purism.
Purism.
Yeah, I like Purism. They make completely uncompensated plug. Purism makes really damn good hardware.
But expensive.
Yeah. Relative to things like ThinkPads.
Yeah,
for
not
sure.
Relative to like they're a MacBook.
It's just because they're doing small runs.
Right.
Yeah, but they're I like, I mean, they have a very high quality product as well.
But I wish it were available to more people. But it makes sense. You're right. It's a small run. And if we put, you know, if more people bought it, then, you know,
So. I agree. I mean, but the other thing about privacy being expensive is that the stuff that you start off with that doesn't surveil you, over time, they add surveillance to it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even the premium products end up being surveillant.
Yeah.
You know, there's this old line that even if you're not the product, if you're not paying for the product, you're the product. Uh-huh. But, you know, John Deere tractors, they lock farmers out of the telemetry that they generate by driving their tractors around their own fields, right? These centimeter accurate soil surveys that collect humidity and density information, which the farmers can't access unless they buy an app that comes with seed from Monsanto, which is now Bayer. Mm-hmm. That data is exfiltrated by Monsanto and sold into the futures market to give insight into regional crop yields. Well, a Monsanto or a John Deere tractor is like a $200,000 to $600,000 investment, right? Mm-hmm. If you're paying for the product, you're that product.
Right.
And it's true that like If you buy a Google phone, they spy on you so they can make money. If you buy an Apple phone, they don't spy on you so they can make money. But they do like spend millions sabotaging right to repair laws all around the country so that they can decide who can fix your device and stop you from getting it fixed when they've decided that it's at the end of life, which, you know, not coincidentally, last year they warned investors that the biggest problem for their earnings was that people weren't disposing of their iPhones. And instead, they were keeping them around and opting to get them fixed.
Right. Yeah, so that's what one thing in the story, it's sort of a mixture of right to repair and DRM. Like, she repairs her toaster. Of course, she doesn't talk about this too much. You know, it's just like a refugee who just learns this stuff on the dark web and says, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
Why, you know, why not? And I noticed that I couldn't help but notice there are only women in this story. there's a boy.
There's a couple of dudes.
There's an
old Serbian refugee.
Okay, yes, the guy who serves him coffee. But it's mostly
a couple of
like
bros.
Was that on purpose to make the heroes the heroines?
I guess. I mean, I think that you know, there's this old saw that we have where, like, we say, oh, this technology needs to be easy enough for my mom to use, right? The thing is that, like, if technology is not designed for you, if you're not in the room and no one's thinking of you when they make the technology, in order to use the technology, you really have to understand it and kind of bend it to your will, use it in ways that weren't intended. So you have to really master it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, if you have the power to shout at people who made technology that doesn't work for you and force them to refactor it, then you find it really easy to use technology. They spend a lot of time thinking about how to make sure you don't shout at them. Mm-hmm. So I like to say technology is so easy your boss can use it, right? Because your boss is the guy who gets to call up, speaking as a former network administrator, right? He gets to call up the ops room and say, like, I don't care about your security, Poindexter. I need to make a presentation in an hour. And as soon as this kid in the Comfort Inn is done with the computer in the lobby, I want to be able to get into the VPN with it. And, you know, you can explain to him that that's like, you know, borrowing a toothbrush that everyone else in the hotel has used all you want. But he can fire you if you don't let him VPN from that computer. Whereas, like, moms, nobody listens to moms. Moms have to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, historically, women have been at the forefront of computing. Women invented computer programming. The among the first and most prolific computer programmers were women. Women are among the most, revered mathematicians. My dad's a mathematician, so I grew up on the history of our most esteemed mathematicians and so on. And so, you know, having women do this, I think, made a lot of sense. I mean, getting your computer to work is a very domestic activity.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, it's sort of a necessity. Necessity is the mother of invention kind of thing. Yeah, because when you think of, you know, I mean, I guess Apple has probably made us think of jailbreakers as the 13-year-old in his basement who wants to just play a game he couldn't play. Wants to, you know, play a game he doesn't want to pay for.
Right.
When that's not what, I mean, it's people making sure that their battery continues to work so they don't have to buy another phone.
Yeah, or you know, people figuring out how to get around a restriction that's been put in place that doesn't serve them and serves someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, like when HP pushes a firmware update out to all of its printers that's disguised as a security update but actually breaks the printer so that it will no longer accept third-party ink, it's the mom who took the kid to Costco and bought a year's worth of ink when it was on sale because they're a low-income family and they can't afford, you know, to pay more than you would for Dom Perignon for commodity ink because it comes in an original HP cartridge. It's that person who has to figure it out. You know, and that's the thing HP did and Epson recently did and Brother appears to have done. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all guilty of this.
So in terms of DRM, are things getting better or are they getting just overall worse?
A little of both. People are more upset about this than they've ever been, particularly on printers. They're really starting to wake up and go, you know, what is this scam? Right to Repair has really centered a lot of interest on this. I was at a meeting in D.C. with a bunch of people from industry. It was Chatham House rules, so I can't say who was who or specifically what lobbyists they represented. But we were talking about DRM, right to repair, and related issues. And there were people who were from the traditional entertainment side, people who did entertainment embedded systems, right? The things like the chip in a car part that has to be activated before the engine will recognize it. Mm-hmm. And there was a growing consensus around the table that American voters and, by extension, American lawmakers and regulators were really grossly offended by the idea that you couldn't fix your own car or take it to an independent mechanic, and that there was not really any way to keep the DMCA intact if that was ever to go to a court challenge, that it would just be so obvious that this was an unfair law when it was couched there. And the thing about the industrial users of DRM is they don't have an iterated game. You know, when DRM in media and in entertainment is challenged, they tend to pick their battles, right? So when Ed Felton, who's now, I forget, he has some really important job in government. He used to be the CTO of the Federal Trade Commission. He was deputy CTO of the White House under Obama. He was then at Princeton. He figured out vulnerabilities in SDMI, the Secure Digital Music Initiative. First, they threatened to sue him if he gave a paper at Usenix. And then when we stepped up to defend him at Electronic Frontier Foundation, the record industry just completely withdrew the complaint, never brought it again, because they knew that a judge didn't want to tell a Princeton mathematician what kind of statistics he could talk about at a learned conference and make that contingent on the approval of a record executive. Mm-hmm. That just seemed like grossly unfair. So they pulled out because they didn't want the DMCA to fall apart. But if you're GM or John Deere, you know, you've only got one bet on DRM, and it's a big bet. And if that bet doesn't pay off, you don't really care if DRM law is still on the books. And so these guys, they're willing to take, they have to take every case, right? They can't afford to just turn a blind eye while people are jailbreaking diagnostic tools for cars or tractors or whatever. And so at this meeting, someone from the entertainment side said, well, maybe to prevent this from going to trial, we should just ask the National Highway Traffic Safety Board or the Department of Transport to just ban the use of DRM in cars, right? You could see the fracture line emerging. You could see, like, literally someone being thrown under the bus there. And I think that probably won't happen. I think instead what will happen is that we'll see more and more abuse of DRM, that will give us more and more cases that we can bring in front of judges. And, you know, we have a case pending. Unfortunately, it's been stuck for years while we've been waiting for our judge to rule on the initial motions. But we're representing Matthew Green, who's one of the eminent security researchers of our time. He's at Johns Hopkins University. And Bunny Huang, the hardware hacker who broke the Xbox. He's an adjunct at MIT at the Media Lab. And we're representing both of them in a First Amendment challenge to the DMCA, to Section 1201 of the DMCA. And, you know, we're also now talking to people about a second challenge because this first one is stalled out in the federal circuit. And we think that if we can actually get the argument in front of a judge, we can take apart the DMCA. And in the meantime, there's much more sense that DRM is just not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, cars are different. They do have different rules right now. Like, I could take my Prius to, I guess it's an authorized Prius dealer.
Right.
Not a Toyota dealership, but a third party.
Toyota, I'm told, and again, I'm not a car guy, Toyota is actually apparently one of the best for providing diagnostics and tools and parts. But GM specifically is a bad offender.
Okay.
And historically, you've been able to take your GM to any mechanic, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, let's not forget that GM was the recipient of a gigantic taxpayer-funded bailout. Mm-hmm. And today, GM uses DRM to lock third-party mechanics out of the diagnostic tools and to lock third-party parts out of their devices, out of their engines.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to the next story, the model minority.
Yeah.
It's a superhero story.
Yeah.
The superhero is not called Superman, which mm-hmm. is surprising to me because I do think you always do push the limits of fair use. Is that not technically fair use if you call them Superman?
I think it might be, but I was able to diverge from the canon by calling him the American Eagle. So I could play with the canon without worrying about continuity so much. So my Superman's been here for 100 years.
Okay.
Right?
But there's also a Batman.
There's also a guy who wears a cowl whose name is Bruce and is a tech millionaire
right.
who sells military gear to governments. Yeah.
And a newspaper reporter named Lois.
Yes. who's Clark's girlfriend.
Right. Yeah. So were you kind of trying to push the limits of fair use?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, particularly when you're playing these games, it makes it very hard to argue that there's any trademark confusion mm-hmm. because anyone who reads it is going like, oh, I see. Clearly this isn't approved, right? Trademark confusion requires that there be, you know, some confusion in the minds of the consumer
that
about the origin of a good or service. And when you see the game being played, you're like, oh, there's no way this is authorized.
Right.
So it's a bit of judo as well. But it's also fun. It's arch and fun to put that stuff in there and, you know, let the reader figure it out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, because I do think that certainly lots of people have pushed that, like lots of giant corporations have pushed that, like, you know, that's not fair use when it's just mixing. And so as an author, do you find, when another interview you did, Leo, you said you never want, as a publishing books, you never wanted someone to use part of your book and then for the publisher to go after them.
Yeah.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I really think that copyright today, it's a form of, like, I call it ladder kicking, right? We creators who are established did a bunch of things that today copyright would enjoin us from doing, as did our publishers. So we've gone up the ladder and now we're kicking it away. And I think that when I did it, you know, when I came home from Star Wars and wrote Star Wars stories out over and over again in 1977, or wrote a crappy Conan novel when I was 12, or, you know, all the other things that I did to learn my craft, that when I did it, it was totally cool. I think it was part of the natural artistic education of an artist. And I think other people should be able to do it too, even if today they would do that and it would show up online where a publisher might find out about it. Mm-hmm. And Macmillan, my publisher, they're very sane about this stuff. And, you know, they defended a Harry Potter dictionary that ultimately the courts said they couldn't do. And they've been really good on this stuff historically. And I'm glad about that. I feel like they've got my back on it.
So the story itself is sort of like a little bit like The Incredibles, but with a race issue.
I guess, yeah.
I just watched Incredibles 2 last night. So
a little less Ayn Rand subtext than The Incredibles, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write Model Minority.
Well, I mean, the most approximate inspiration was reading Matt Taibbi's book about the killing of Eric Garner by this NYPD goon squad. The book's called I Can't Breathe. And the cops who killed Eric Garner, they had been savagely beating black people for a very long time. They were well known. They wore these t-shirts that had a quote from Hemingway that talked about how glorious it was to hunt humans. Mm-hmm. And it was like super ha-ha only serious. They were racking up these huge civil rights settlements with their victims. And, you know, I had a reaction that I think a lot of us have when we read these stories. We think, like, why didn't someone just step in and stop them, right? Why couldn't some individual stop this systemic problem? And the answer is right there in the framing, because it's a systemic problem. You know, if an individual who stepped in would not have been able to do anything. And even if it was Superman, they would have run up against the limits of it, because unless we address this on a systemic level, we can't get past it. But of course, we've also had 40 years of, you know, Reagan-style doctrine that all of our problems are individual problems and all the solutions are individual solutions, right? If you think climate change is a problem, you need to personally change what kind of car you drive and do more recycling, as opposed to having some kind of big systemic change that makes it easier not to need a car, or that makes the waste streams easier to separate, or, you know, puts things in refillable bottles the way they were when I was a kid. You know, in Ontario, when I was a kid, all soda pop came in a standardized bottle that the province would take back in at the curb, wash, and then send back out to the manufacturers. And those bottles went around and around and around. And Coke killed that because they wanted the traditional Coke bottle shape, right? So, you know, we think of these things as all having individual solutions and individual sources, origins in the problem. And, you know, Superman's dealing with this systemic problem and realizing that he's part of it, right? Realizing that even as he was fighting for truth, justice in the American way, he was also ignoring the lynching of Emmett Till. I really wanted to dig into who the protagonist of these stories about addressing problems of racism are. It's not the white person who wakes up one day and decides enough is enough, they're going to be an ally. That's a thing Superman discovers pretty early on in this story, that the actual story is the story of the black person who he thinks he's rescued, but in fact who he's put into even more harm's way as a result of his actions. And you know, the only question Superman needs to answer ultimately is what took him so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it really resonates with that idea, you know, the pushback of, like, the Oscars, you know, like Green Book and all these stories where, I mean, that wasn't necessarily a savior story, but you think about the white savior. And it really is, like, this black guy who's just been beat is like, I do not want your help. Like, you're going to make it worse.
Yeah.
And he does.
Yeah. And you know, the thing that he also comes to realize is that his dear pal Bruce Wayne is the one who's been selling the city of New York its predictive policing tools that are the reason that there's so much racist over policing. It's actually a really good example of that from here locally in the Bay Area. There's a company called Predpol, started by a Berkeley professor. It's the leading vendor of predictive policing tools in America. And in San Francisco, there's a group called the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, founded by Patrick Ball. They mostly, what they do is very rigorous statistical extrapolations of the full scope of war crimes by doing rigorous random sampling and then figuring what crimes weren't detected. They found mass graves in Mexico, and they documented the genocidal attacks on Yazidi, and were involved in the Truth and Reconciliation in East Timor and South Africa and in the former Yugoslavia and so on. And that team decided to evaluate Predpol's rigor, because the theory that critics of Predpol have is they sell into cities that are worried about racist over policing, biased policing. And they say, okay, well, we're going to use an algorithm to figure out where the police should go and look for crime. We're going to train that algorithm with our arrest data. Well, if you start from the premise that you have racist over policing, then you'll have racist arrest data too. Mm-hmm. And that what this does is provide a form of like empirical face wash for biased practices. And so they said, all right, let's take the drug arrest data from Oakland and ask Predpol's algorithm where the drug crimes will be next year. And if you look at that slide, you see this like red dot in the middle of the blackest part of the blackest neighborhood in Oakland, right? And then they went to the National Institutes of Health, who do an annual survey of drug use that reveals where the actual drug use was in Oakland. And the whole city is kind of pink, right? Because people use drugs at about the same rate, but black people get arrested for it more often than white people. Mm-hmm. And you can see in these two slides, which, you know, tomorrow morning I'm going to be at a juvenile offender facility in just outside of Portland, and I'm going to be presenting to the kids, and I'm going to present this slide. You see this in these two slides how machine learning can supercharge racism and make it unassailable. Because, you know, back when we called machine learning just statistics, we knew how to critique it. We'd say, like, what's your sampling methodology, right? How rigorous are you being in your statistical methodologies? Are you p-hacking and so on? But today, because we call it machine learning and big data and data science and artificial intelligence, it's shrouded in mystery. And we say, well, the conclusions of the algorithm cannot be interrogated. They merely have to be obeyed, you know? And you can see in this slide just how quickly that gets really dark and dystopic.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, this example, then the algorithm is the superhero that's making things worse.
Well, no, it's the software that Batman's selling to the city that sent those cops to that neighborhood that had them open that black guy's door and drag him out of his car and start beating the crap out of him.
Right. But then in the world we're living in, everyone who gets up and says, you know, we're going to solve the racism in policing through this algorithm.
Yeah.
We're going to solve it with this algorithm because computers don't lie. It's just math, and it's going to not have our bias in it.
Yeah, and you know, you see that also in algorithmic sentencing tools, algorithmic parole recommendation tools, algorithmic loan tools. There are so many ways in which these things ripple out. You know, algorithmic tools for identifying kids at high risk who need intervention by Child and Protective Services. And there are ways, you know, it's interesting. There are ways in which these tools actually hurt some of the most privileged among us, particularly in cases of domestic violence, because the way that domestic violence is most frequently detected by the police is a neighbor who hears it through a wall phones it in. Mm-hmm. And if you live in a detached house, you have a much lower likelihood of getting police intervention if you are the victim of domestic violence. And yet, domestic violence occurs at an even rate across all demographics. Mm-hmm. And so again, if we just call this statistics, we could just look at sampling methodologies and what they weren't capturing. But because we call it machine learning, there's a kind of priesthood who insists that it's all shrouded in mystery and can't really be interrogated.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like that is changing, I hope. I mean, people are understanding it.
Maybe. I mean, yeah. I hope so. I hope we're having a much more critical discussion now.
Right.
You know, between Human Rights Data Analysis Group, the AI Now Institute in New York, and other organizations, we're getting a much better critical discourse on this stuff. And Oakland passed the first of its kind legislation in America that requires the police to consult with the public and accept notice before they buy in these policing and surveillance tools. And, you know, that particularly makes it harder for companies to sell to cities under non-disclosure and non-disparagement clauses. So, you know, the biggest vendor of automatic license plate recognition tools, Vigilant, binds all the cities they sell into to non-disparagement clauses. So if you find that your Vigilant license plate camera is like leaking data or sending the cops to the wrong house or doing other things that would make them not fit for purpose, you're not allowed to complain in public without Vigilant's permission, right? So as a municipal taxpayer, you're paying for your city to buy these so-called solutions, but they're not allowed to know if it works before they buy it, and they're not allowed to tell anyone else if it doesn't work after they've bought it.
What would happen if you complained about it?
You'd be subject to legal retaliation, right? You'd have violated your contract.
Wow. So let's move on to the next story.
Sure.
Radicalized. Tell us what inspired you to write this one.
Yeah, so it's a story in which, against all odds, furious, entitled, heartbroken white dudes, instead of killing their ex-partners or brown people going to mosques, start killing healthcare executives whose callous decisions have doomed the people they love best to die slow and painful deaths by ruling out the courses of care that have been recommended from being included by insurance. Mm-hmm. This is obviously a pretty common occurrence in this country. And, you know, there are lots of reasons to write that story. One, though, was about our narrative about radicalization itself. The narrative of radicalization goes that there are people who are just regular old people walking around, and then they meet someone who is a radical, and they get radicalized by that person. And that radicalization process, it's kind of like a mind control ray. And once you've been zapped with it, you are now radicalized and you go and do something terrible and violent in the world. And if only we could stop these sort of patient zeros from brainwashing everyday people, then the radicalization would stop. The actual research data on what goes into radicalization doesn't really support this model. Boston University psychologists did a big research study about 10 years ago where they did case histories on a bunch of West Bank suicide bombers or occupied territory suicide bombers. And they found that the typical suicide bomber was someone who'd been so traumatized that they were suicidal. And then someone came along and whispered in their ear and said, if you're going to do it, don't let it go to waste, right? So that suggests that if you want to address radicalization, the way to address it is by addressing the sources of trauma and of precarity and of anxiety. But instead, our anti-radicalization strategy, it takes the form of, you know, kind of the crappy apology, which goes like, I'm really sorry you're so angry at me, right? Our radicalization strategy, our de-radicalization strategy goes, I'm really sorry that this trauma made you so traumatized. But we're not going to stop the trauma. Could you just try being a little less traumatized by it and therefore less vulnerable? You know, and this, you see this playing out in lots of ways. The term incel was actually coined by a queer Canadian woman who started a message board for people like her who struggled to find physical intimacy. And what she realized after some time on this message board was that while in a normal support message board, the people who hung around the longest would be the people who'd solved their problems and who were there to kind of reassure people, mm-hmm. oh, you know, you went off the wagon, but you can get back on again. Let me tell you when it happened to me and I'm sober now. And on incel message boards, anyone who figured it out left. And the only people who were still there were the people who couldn't figure it out, who were bitter and beyond redemption and who were, you know, taking these already traumatized and hurting people and then guiding them into this deeper and darker place, right? And creating this, you know, what has now become a terrorist threat. You know, 10 people killed by a guy in a white van in Toronto who was radicalized on an incel message board because he was so traumatized, because he was so broken, because he was so fragile, right? And it's this nexus of these two things that turned him into who he was. And so I wanted to write that story, write the story about someone who nearly loses a loved one to a preventable cancer, is saved by a miracle of spontaneous remission, but then finds himself staying on this message board, partly because he can't recover from his own trauma, and partly because he realizes that he's the only one there who's not broken, who's mm-hmm. taking new people in. And when those people start killing healthcare executives and senators and lobbyists, he is convinced that he's doing the right thing by staying there, and is also somewhat convinced that it would take a really long time to start calling respectable white guys terrorists. And he's right, it does. Even when they're killing people who are much richer and more powerful than them, it takes about 6 suicide bombings before they're called terrorists. And, you know, it's got a kind of, without giving it away, a kind of uncomfortable ending. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely the case that rights are never given. They're always taken.
It's amazing. This is a short novella, and there's so much going on. Like you said, it's about trauma. Mm-hmm. And message boards. And it makes me also think about how we talk about, it's so dangerous on YouTube, or there's like the Momo or whatever, you know, right. We're always, or like, don't let your girl go on Snapchat or else she's going to be, you know, some kidnapper is going to get her or something. Right. It's like, you know, I'm sure you know this too. It's like there's a problem, you know, it's self-esteem can be an issue there.
Right.
Like it's
right.
Every time someone's going to fall victim of some crazy YouTuber, the YouTuber isn't the first problem, right?
Right. Like, yeah. And you know, in public health problems, and I think of these things as public health problems, we know that the most important thing to work on is prevention, not cures. Cures are a sign that you failed in your prevention. And you know, things like, what do I do to stop my kid who's been traumatized from being victimized, mm-hmm. are curative, not preventative, and averting the trauma itself, you know, mm-hmm. finding a way in which, for example, speaking as the father of an 11, oh goodness, I managed to come on your TV show.
That's okay.
And not mute my phone because I'm an idiot.
I can't believe it didn't ring until now.
I didn't hit do not disturb. I turned on no data because it has literally exactly the same icon. I'm a dum-dum. Speaking as the father of an 11-year-old girl whose grandmother just called me, I am very anxious about this stuff too. You know, yeah. I worry that she's in a milieu that traumatizes young women, mm-hmm. and that's not entirely within my control. But I also recognize that for every bit of work that I put into sort of helping her deal with the everyday trauma of being a kid, I need to be putting at least some energy into these systemic problems that are leading her there. Otherwise, I'm going to fight a losing battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do.
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah, fair enough.
you just said you were going to speak. Where are you going to speak next? At a juvenile detention center?
Yeah,
yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're doing your part. but it's also the other question I had reading this is, you know, he's on this message board for people, men dealing with cancer of
their
relative.
Loved ones. Yeah.
And then you said that these bombings, like, what is our responsibility when, you know, to report something like that? I mean, he sort of struggles with that. Is that part of the story as well? Like when you're on a message board, how do you get help to an anonymous person that you're communicating with?
Yeah, I don't know that I have an answer. But, you know, the thing that I was more thinking of is how when you have a just cause, there will be people who fight on your side who are monsters, but they're your monsters, mm-hmm. and you accept them. You know, I always think about George Orwell, who's, you know, a hero of mine. I wrote this book called Little Brother and mm-hmm. so on. I have a first edition of 1984 at home. And Orwell, it's not well known, but, you know, he went and fought in the Spanish Civil War, and he was shot through the throat by a Stalinist. So he was fighting for the anarchists, and the Stalinists, who were on the same side as the anarchists, started shooting at the anarchists to liquidate them because they were as scared of their allies as they were the fascists. Mm. And he was furious with the Stalinists for the rest of his life for good reason, for good reason beyond his personal reason. At the end of his life, he fell in love with a secret police woman, a precursor to MI5. And he made her a list of his friends who he thought were secret Stalinists so that she could spy on them. This is George Orwell.
No.
Right? When we come to grips with the monsters who were our monsters after the fight is done, we sometimes come to a very uncomfortable space, and figuring out whether or not we're going to embrace those people or repudiate them, it's really tough. I think it's a thing that a lot of people in the age of Me Too are really struggling with. People who they idolized or lionized, who turn out to have been monsters in their own way, and they have to figure out where do they sit now in this new history of the causes they believed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially considering how much has changed and, you know, what standards were then and now, and where do you, you know... Yeah, that is, it was a really good question. Okay, so the last story, The Mask of the Red Death.
Yeah.
It's about preppers.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a happy story about preppers.
No. Well, and I guess that's one of the things is, how is it that we ever had happy stories about preppers to begin with? You know? It's, there is this really toxic idea that when civilization ends, that what you should do is run and hide in a luxury bunker while people who are lesser than you are nevertheless the ones who go and get civilization rebooted. And that when it's all done, you can kind of grab your guns and your thumb drives full of Bitcoin and your gemstone quality precious stones, and you can ride out and live a kind of Frazetta painting fantasy where you can take over the operation that they've rebuilt and have a harem and be a warlord and all the rest of it. The reality is that any disaster that starts with the death of billions of people, if it doesn't also include a massive cleanup effort and sanitation and lots of other things, will end with the death of all the people who survived from the communicable diseases that grow on giant mountains of corpses, right? And it doesn't matter really how many guns you have. You just can't shoot germs. And, you know, if you think that you're going to survive the disaster by bugging out, you should really be revisiting it and thinking about bugging in. But there's something about the character of especially the very wealthy who want to bug out, which tells you everything you need to know about who they are. They don't think of themselves as having a shared destiny with the rest of us. Mm-hmm. They think of themselves as being entirely separate from us and not part of whatever it is that binds us together as a society.
Well, I don't want to say any more about the story. So that one was sad. I won't say more about that. Let's talk a little bit just about, in general, science fiction and writing. How hard is it to write when things are moving so fast? Mm. And when, I mean, is there a way in which, like, some of these things could occur, but in the distant, in the very near future, how do you go about writing in that way?
Yeah, I think if you want to future-proof a science fiction story, one really good way to do it is to assume that computer science is going to remain relatively stable. Computer science has been stable for, you know, 50 years. We make some improvements at the margins, but most of our improvements are in computer engineering, right? Computer science, you know, Turing completeness, von Neumann machines, and so on, that's pretty stable. And so, like, there have been a bunch of computer science questions that we've had for a long time, like, can we make a computer that runs all the programs except for the one that makes Hollywood angry or a cop angry? We don't know how to make that computer. We probably never will, right? Can we make crypto that works except when the police need it to fail, but will work well enough to, like, protect firmware updates for your pacemaker? No, right? We either make crypto that works as well as we know how to make it work, or it will have vulnerabilities that will be exploited by bad guys as well as good guys. And yet, our lawmakers continue to fail to come to grips with this spectacularly. You know, the former prime minister of Australia was prime minister for like about 15 minutes. They get a new prime minister every 6 months or so because their democracy is in even worse shape than ours. Take comfort. The former PM of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, when he was pushing for legislation that ultimately passed to ban working crypto in Australia, was told that the laws of mathematics mean that you cannot make crypto that works to protect the secrets that good guys need to protect, but doesn't work to protect the secrets bad guys want to protect. Mm. And he said, the laws of mathematics are very commendable, I'm sure. But I assure you that in Australia, the laws of Australia are the laws of Australia. It's the stupidest thing anyone has ever said, right? Imagine if he was referring to, like, why pi can't be made equal to 3 with a stroke of a pen. It'd be immediately obvious that this is going to get him into trouble the first time he tries to put a wheel on the presidential car, right? Prime ministerial car. And so, if you assume that computers will become more important day to day, that the theoretical underpinnings of computers will remain relatively stable, and that lawmakers will continue to make rules about these increasingly important computers that are not in accord with the underlying principle, then you can make fiction that will serve as a parable for understanding all manner of increasingly horrific and terrible policy ruptures that we will have in our future to come. And so that's my, like, secret sauce. That's why Little Brother, a novel that's 12 or 13 years old now from when I first started writing it, remains extremely relevant and, you know, taught in the Cyber Institute at West Point, and, you know, the Uber security group, security and privacy group, just had it as their book club book, and Ed Snowden took a copy of the sequel with him when he went on the run. You know, like, the reason that book remains relevant is because those are my bedrock principles for plotting, and sadly, they remain good principles for future-proofing fiction. And if they stop being good principles for future-proofing fiction, it will be a small price to pay for living in a much better policy world. It'll be because in some small way that fiction will have done its job.
Mm-hmm. And what are you allowed to talk about that's coming out that you
want? I think everything. So Unauthorized Bread has been sold to Topic, which is the TV arm of The Intercept. It's being adapted for TV. The audiobook for Radicalized is out now. It's a deal with Macmillan and Google Play, and Google Play has now launched a DRM-free Audible alternative, and you can get it there. And Will Wheaton reads one of the stories on it. First Second, which is part of Macmillan, is doing a kids' book of mine next year called Posey the Monster Slayer. I have a new essay collection coming out probably in 2021. Called Control. The other two were called Context and Content. And I've just turned in the third Little Brother book. The working title was Crypto Wars. My editor hates that title. He says it's a nonfiction title. So I have a bunch of other titles I'm thinking of. One is Zero Day. One is Attack Surface. One is Hopeful Monster. I don't know if any of those will end up flying.
Okay. But that will be out soon. And this soon.
It's been accepted but not contracted, so we don't have a publication date yet.
Do you think Snowden will come back for the third version?
Well, maybe he'll do another tour event with me. He did one for Walkaway. He came in by video screen at the New York Public Library. It was amazing. It was one of the best nights of my life.
Wow. I remember that. Well, thank you, Cory Doctorow, joining us. Cory's newest book, Radicalized, it's four tales of our present. Highly recommend it. You can get it wherever books are sold. And you can, is Crap Hound still your website?
Yeah, craphound.com/shop. So. You can get it DRM-free there. I'm a retailer for my publisher. So you can, if you want to have me keep the 25% that Jeff Bezos would normally take, buy the ebooks there and sideload them into your device of choice.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Of course, he's Dr. O on Twitter.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking to me. That's great.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on Triangulation. We record Triangulation every week. You can get it any podcast catcher you have. And subscribe so that it comes right to you. And we will see you next week. Thanks so much for joining us.